Good afternoon. Today is Monday, the 29th of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Diane McCaddy, speaking from Scotland, and Mark Anderson, speaking from the United States. Welcome to you both. So, Diane, we're going to bring you in straight away because we've got some really interesting events unfolding north of the border, and it looks as though Hamza is a little bit wobbly.
It looks like he has finally fallen off his scooter once and for all, Brian. Really happy to say that. So just to summarize how we got to this point, just an hour ago, he officially announced in Bute House, which is the official residence of the First Minister of Scotland, that he is stepping down as First Minister and will only remain in post until his replacement is found. It's been an interesting several days in Scottish politics, and I've been watching it very closely. It started out with their fallout with the Scottish Greens, where they were looking at the climate issues. So the Greens were saying they wanted this net zero agenda to go on, and SNP were saying it's not possible. So SNP pulled out of that agreement, which made them a majority coalition government in Scotland. But it seems as though the issue with the climate has not been the only thing. There's also been the gender identity issues, which, again, the Greens and the SNP were having some issues around agreeing on. But really, they should have been a nationalist party, but they were putting all of these identity politics in front of the idea of nationalism and Scottish independence. So there have been two confidence votes that were supposed to be coming up this week in Scotland. One started by the Tories, which was no confidence in the First Minister himself. The second one was the government in general, which is going to be brought forth by Labour. The Greens said over the weekend that they would vote against any vote of confidence in favor of Hamza or in favor of, you know, anything that he's supporting. And because of the way the mathematics works out, there's no way that he could get enough votes needed. There was the possibility of Ash Regan, who defected to the ALBA party, which is Alex Salmond's also nationalist party, a while ago, but she did not also agree with what he was doing. He certainly wasn't on the side of the Tories because they all said that, you know, why should we support him when he's been calling in the last several months to get all Tory MSPs out of Scotland, kind of forgetting that we are still part of the UK up here. So it seems as though he just doesn't have enough friends or anyone backing him. So he really didn't have any choice, Brian, but to step down.
Yeah, incredible events. And I'm going to be watching it with interest because I felt for a great many years that the aim of politics inside UK was to break the union apart. And so further trouble inside Scotland itself, I think, is welcomed by many people who are following the globalist agenda. That's my personal opinion. And let's move on to the subject of universities and academics, because some of his policies have been impinging on that, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as a bit of a segue into that, I was watching the resignation speech that he just gave leading up to coming onto the news. And what he was straight into what I'm going to talk about, quote, people who looked like me, so not white, were not in positions of political influence, let alone leading governments when I was younger. But we now live in a UK that has a British Hindu prime minister, a black Welsh first minister, and for a little while longer, a Scottish Asian first minister of this country. So for those who decry that multiculturalism has failed across the UK, I would suggest the evidence is quite the contrary, and that is something we should all celebrate. So what happened recently is, this was in the Daily Mail just over the weekend, what's happening is that academics across the UK are getting cut, their jobs are getting cut, including people like me, saying that they are in favor of hiring DEI consultants, executives, with their salaries exceeding, you know, all close to £100,000 a year. Which is even more than a professor like me makes. And so the vice chancellors are doing this in favor of subject-based academics and subject-based teaching. And so this is really difficult for a lot of reasons. We don't really know what universities are prioritizing, but what I want to talk about in relation to that is what's happening in the schools at lower levels in the UK and what students are going to be learning in schools and when they reach university level. So as a result of all this, with the departments being shut down, with academics who have subject expertise being canceled or losing their jobs completely, the EDI, Equality, Diversity, Inclusion workforce, seems to be increasing, while those of us with subject expertise appear to be going away. So here I would like to bring in Dr. Alka Cuthbert. She is, her family is from India originally. She's British. She has been canceled several times for making people feel unsafe because she doesn't believe in discrimination one way or the other. In fact, she can see that she's the director of this organization based in London called Don't Divide Us, which is really truly based on equality. And let's all work together. Everyone has something important to say. Everyone has value. We don't need to be prioritizing one way or the other on issues of race. So next, I'd like to show a video that thankfully my husband, John McCaddy, recorded and edited. I was presenting with her in March at a Scottish Union for Education event. And I'd just like to play first a short clip of what she said in our session. And then I'd like to talk about that a bit.
They sat and listened, they sat and allowed themselves to be lectured and hectored for 2 hours. And then all the primary school teachers were given boxes to go into their classrooms and remove every book that was not racially representative. So, which they did. And my friend that told me this, who was a teacher there, was almost in tears as she was saying she felt so ashamed. She said she felt violated, because she had spent so many years working up lesson plans and schemes of work. And she knew the books that she had were traditional fairy tales and stories of the kind of books that Cambridge and Oxbridge neuroscientists are now saying helps children read. And they were they had to think of other books to replace them with. That was the afternoon session, once they'd got rid of their books. And of course, you know, there isn't, you know, probably there may well be books of authors of colour which are brilliant, which are lovely, but the work hasn't been done to look for them, right? There's been no actual research or scholarly work done on looking for them. It's just find anybody with the right skin colour and the right non-English Western name. And you get Laura, what's her name, Alan, Henry Allen type books in there. You can't, like Stuart said, you cannot educate if this belief system is allowed to continue.
And that's my concern, is that, you know, we're replacing education, subject-based education, actually teaching students to be able to do things with these ideologies and these beliefs. And so as a discussant in that panel, what I did was I replied with an academic paper that I have known for several years, which comes out of cognitive psychology in the 1970s, which found it's been cited maybe 10,000 times in the academic literature, very well tested. And what they found was that children describe things with natural categories. So somebody sees a person as a child who hasn't learned that, you know, people are supposed to have different labels or go into different categories. You see a person, you say that's a person. You don't say that's a black person or a white person. You don't say it's a mammal. You say it's somewhere that is the most recognizable category. And so from that, we can see that it just doesn't make any sense, even from a learning or a cognition perspective, to be able to teach students or to be able to tell them this person is black, this person is white, this person is this other thing. But what is the literature saying in more recent times from education and from my field of informatics? Well, we're looking at how to teach children to be anti-racist, which of course is racist in itself, because we're saying that people are different for different reasons and mainly because of their skin color. So we're talking here about how to use books to teach black children that they are different, or different people of different races are different, and here's why. This one was a particularly interesting paper using anti-racism educational methods during COVID, right? So everything was bad enough during COVID for education. And now we've got to put anti-racism on top of teaching students that we're all dying from this apparently raging pandemic. So the layers of interestingness, I guess you could say, just get worse and worse. I have a couple of these books that I actually have here in print next to me. This one is one from Laura Henry Allen, who was the author that Dr. Cuthbert mentioned in the segment I showed, called My Skin, Your Skin. And I'm not sure how well you can see the picture I've taken from one of those pages, but what you can see is that the word white, my cousin is white, is a lowercase w. And you can see my friend is black is an uppercase B, and the same with Chinese and the same with Ghanaian. So we can see here the agenda, going back to Hamza's point around multiculturalism and different people of different races being in charge. And we can see what's happening to what is traditionally a white country here in the UK. The next one I have here is a lift the flap, questions and answers about racism. So we're talking about children who are reading picture books young enough to have things like pop-ups and lift-ups and things where we would expect children to be learning about, you know, what were the dinosaurs, what are the seasons of the year, the things that we expect children to need to learn at very young ages. Now we're teaching them how to be activists. And it says there, how to become part of the situation. So again, we're teaching them once again that they have to show that they're different. They have to do these different things. Here's one from children who are maybe a few years older about how to do art projects that allow us to explore anti-racism. And this is from a chapter on advocacy from the book. So we see here that it's not just about anti-racism. It's about all of the social justice issues that they're supposed to be concerned with. So instead of making, you know, creative art projects that express whatever it is that they're interested in, there's a whole list of all of the things that adults don't even know what to do with: addiction, ageism, animal welfare, bullying, censorship, guidance, civil rights. It goes on and on. And so these are all the things that these kids are encouraged to do art projects about, including a specific set of instructions about how to make that black fist fighting for equity. And remember, equity and equality are different things. We are teaching equity, not equality. And this is what our children are expected to be exposed to as they grow up nowadays. So, Brian, I don't know about you, but I'm happy that I grew up in a different generation.
Diane, thank you very much. Well, yes, I think I could say that as well as we see things unfold around us. But it's very interesting as you were talking through in detail about what you're seeing and what's in the books for very young children. Somebody commented in our chat box and said it's cultural revolution unfolding right in front of our eyes. And that is exactly what it is. And I'll say I'm very encouraged that here we are in 2024. And it's obvious that many, many people are seeing that something's wrong. And many people are starting to see exactly what it is. But what a situation north of the border, that we've now got the friction between the identity of people is dominating politics, not solving everyday problems of who's got a job, who's got a house to live in, who can feed themselves. This has all been overtaken by the woke agenda. And at the same time, we're now starting to get rid of academics from the institutions which should be providing the best in education for our children. It's pretty extraordinary. Diane, a quick question for you. Are there other professionals around you who are also seeing this? So I know that you've said before you're feeling quite isolated, but are there any other academics standing up?
Not that I've seen. Obviously, friends of the column like Norman Fenton, but he's retired. He has the freedom to do this. I do belong to a couple of organizations called, one is called the Academics for Academic Freedom. So I'm a member of the steering committee of the Edinburgh branch up here. I'm also a member of the Scottish Union for Education, but of course that entails all levels of education, not just universities. So those of us in the Academics for Academic Freedom group are doing what we can, but we are a very, very small minority in a big sea of people that are just going right along with the agenda. And I don't think that they're seeing what's coming for them, unfortunately.
Okay, Diane, thank you very much for that report, and keep going. Now, we're just going to move over to Ukraine, which is obviously a horrific war, ongoing minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day. But of course, in the West in general, the legacy media simply not reporting reality. But unfortunately, this is also the case by the Ukrainians' own internal media. So let's have a look at a couple of reports. The Kiev Independent we've used before. So if you have a look down the sidebar, it's talking about Latvia donating energy equipment to Ukraine after Russian attacks on infrastructure. Is talking about military intelligence, where Telegram is blocking several Ukrainian government chat bots. It's got general staff telling or claiming that Russia has lost 467,000 plus troops in Ukraine since February the 24th, 2022. And it goes on to talk about the actual number of Russians killed in Ukraine. But of course, the reality is that Ukraine is suffering very badly on the front. And because of the huge excess of Russian artillery over Ukrainian artillery, and the fact Ukraine is now short of munitions, casualties on the Ukrainian side much higher than the Russians. Here's the Kiev Post, just come on screen. Russia must withdraw from Ukraine, plain and simple. And this is based on a statement by Zelensky. So even in the Ukrainian media itself, we are not seeing realistic reporting about what's actually happening on the battlefield. All of the reports are as if the war is continuing largely in Ukraine's favour. And if it's not entirely in their favour, it will be all right at some stage in the future and Ukraine will retake Crimea. Complete nonsense. If we have a look at Western reports, I've just taken one newspaper article here. If we can pop that one on screen, please. Ukraine-Russia war live. Putin's troops advance as Kiev's commander-in-chief says the frontline situation is worsening. Well, this is the Independent. They've virtually got it there. But if we compare it with the really accurate reports that have been coming in from social media, so this is Military Summary Channel. We've got Weeb Union. What are they talking about? Russian breakthroughs on key areas of the front. And of course, the Russians are managing to do this by the fact that they can use an extraordinary amount of artillery to destroy Ukrainian defensive positions before they move forward. But also it's now very clear the Russians are able to deploy large numbers of very large guided aerial bombs, which are simply destroying the Ukrainian strong points. So massive Ukrainian casualties, but this is not being reported at all in Western media, or it appears in Ukrainian media. If we have a look at the UK's Ministry of Defence, really just pure propaganda. I've chosen a little bit from the Twitter, or X as it's now called. But what are they talking about? Since 2023, there's been a record 30% increase in Russian men aged 31 to 59 with disabilities. So the British Ministry of Defence crowing about injuries to Russian servicemen and women. The one that's just come in on screen, we've now got reports on the number of civilians that have been killed in Ukrainian areas. So there's nothing which is of substance about the war on the ground. There is nothing talking about the advances of the Russians, which is now happening on an hour-by-hour, day-by-day basis. So we pour in the weapons and munitions, we extend the war, but the outcome is clear. Ukraine is going to lose, and Ukraine is being devastated as this happens. Now, something that's been occurring over the last couple of days that's caused the West immense embarrassment is the fact that captured Western equipment has now been taken to Russia. So let's just play this little clip from the Mail. I'll talk you through it, but essentially here is Western equipment, which Russia has taken off the battlefield, cleaned it up, and has now put it on display for Russians to see that the Western wonder weapons, including the German and the American main battle tanks, have simply failed to make any difference at all. Abraham's on screen. And, Leopard on screen, but also the Abrams tanks have completely failed to deliver the successes which the West and the US in particular has said would come with the weapons. So as long as the war goes on, and as long as the West, the UK, the US and the EU pump in the weapons, the more Ukrainians are going to die and the less is going to be left to that country. Mark, I'm going to bring you in at this point because you've been having a look at really the emergence of a new Cold War. But this one is a hot Cold War, if that's not too confusing a statement.
Thanks, Brian. Good day to everyone. Yes, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, as I've noted, is among the busiest, if not the busiest, globalist think tanks in the entire world, let alone in the United States. So I follow them very closely in real time. I covered it firsthand last Thursday, I believe it was. It was April 24, if memory serves. But New Cold War is a conversation with David Sanger. That's a referral to a veteran New York Times reporter. New Cold Wars in the plural means, as he explained to Ewald Dalder, the CEO of the Chicago Council, the old Cold War was basically binary, you know, the U.S. versus the USSR, and it was the arms race and that big strategic standoff. The new Cold Wars is plural, where the U.S. is, or the West, you might say, led by the U.S., is facing not just Russia, but China, and now Iran is aligned with Russia and China. So without going into too much geopolitical shuffling, that's what David Sanger explained. This slide here explains a little bit about David Sanger himself. He's the White House and National Security Correspondent for the Times, reporting on President Biden and his administration with a particular focus on foreign policy, and that intersects with technology, politics, and superpower conflict. He is a rather candid reporter, and he had some things to say, Brian, that underscore the idea that actually Russia is doing quite well in this conflict and Ukraine is losing. He didn't say Ukraine's absolutely losing, but he did concede that they're not on the winning side. This is a photo I took here of a couple original photos through the screenshot function of the program. That's Sanger on the left with Ewald Dalder. Now, moving on from there, I'll just explain a couple things before we get into a couple quick video clips. Another thing that Mr. Sanger mentioned of interest, you've reflected back to the George W. Bush years of 2002, Brian, and mentioned that at that time there was even a NATO-Russia Council, which later became the NATO-Ukraine Council, no surprise there. And there was U.S.-Russia counterterrorism coordination meetings just after 9/11, and Sanger was covering this. And Russia was considering joining NATO back then, Mr. Sanger reminded the audience. And Russia was considering joining the European Union. He's saying how quickly we forget these strange geopolitical circumstances. And he said that the West misread Putin, thinking that he would not be aggressive militarily, that he would not want to risk the oil and gas revenues that are such an important part of the Russian economy. And he also claimed that the U.S. failed to understand that China would act like it's democratizing its country by allowing more local elections through different means, but it was really just a steam valve, and China was acting as if it's democratizing, but the Chinese Communist Party actually isn't. That's another point Mr. Sanger made, an interesting one to consider. And now we'll play the video clips, and then I'll have some commentary from there.
Bush and Putin were talking about Putin joining the European Union. You remember the discussions about whether Russia would join NATO. There was a NATO-Russia Council inside the gate of NATO. It's now the NATO-Ukrainian Council, but at that time, it did not seem out of the realm of possibility that they would join NATO. There's a similar and parallel story we'll get to later about China. But we went from that 22 years ago to Putin warning in 2007 at the Munich Security Conference that there were parts of Peter the Great's Russia that had been separated from the motherland and had to come back, and we ignored it. And 7 years later, there's a chapter called The Seven-Year Itch with apologies to Marilyn Monroe, he takes Crimea, and there are no sanctions for a year. And then, after there are a few mild ones, the Germans immediately sign up. Chancellor Merkel signs the Nord Stream 2 agreement to bring gas directly from Russia into Germany, going around Ukraine. So they got none of the revenue. And she calls Putin a reliable supplier. So what was he supposed to conclude if he tried to take all of Ukraine, that the U.S. would kind of roll over with NATO. They'd complain a lot. They'd do a few sanctions, and they'd go away. He was not taking a wild bet.
Some interesting remarks there. It's interesting on the one hand, Brian, that he admitted that there's a historical reason, going back to Peter the Great, that Russia might want to acquire or reacquire parts of Ukraine. We've often said that whether you agree with Putin or not, he does have matters of state and statecraft to consider in this. But it's also interesting that he just says, well, they invaded Crimea. The Russian story is that there was, of course, Russian-leaning people in Crimea, just like in eastern Ukraine, that really desired to be back with Mother Russia, and that Ukraine, the Kiev government, was basically a criminal imposter regime. So that's some things that we could counter or offer as counterpoint to that video clip. Now we have one other video clip of particular interest.
We sent last year a bunch of American-made drones and gave them to the Ukrainians for both surveillance and delivering ordnance. By that time, the Russians, who had terrible electronic warfare at the beginning of the war, had figured out what they were doing wrong. They took every American drone down in about 90 minutes. You know, and this was one of those programs where some good contractor from Silicon Valley had come along and said, "Dad, don't worry, these things are invulnerable, this is going to work." Didn't last for 2 hours. That's a lesson.
It's a lesson. I mean, the part of the lesson is the U.S. is getting a lot of good information on the cheap, including the destruction of much of the Russian army.
Yeah, so there again, it shows the U.S. failure on the technological realm. Much could be said about this. The speaker, Mr. Sanger, lastly, just for this segment, Brian, mentioned that Google had a project for drone targeting, but it ultimately rejected it, called Project Maven, M-A-V-E-N. And that was moved to Palantir and about 12 to 15 other contractors. Palantir, Alex Karp attends Bilderberg every year. He's the head of Palantir. And by the time the Ukrainian war breaks out, they've got this incredible picture of how troops are laid out. And anyway, Project Maven is all about less human involvement in drone targeting and more AI targeting. But that's precisely what failed versus the Russian army. So there'll probably be more on this that I can unpack for maybe one more report next week, Brian, but that's sufficient for now.
Thank you very much for that, Mark. And the thing that came into my mind as you were talking is that some people have always felt that Putin and the West were all working together, that the war in Ukraine even was something that the Russians wanted to happen, and Russia is really working with the West. But when you start to dig into it and you see this massive change from Russia coming on board with NATO and the European Union to Russia at war in the eastern part of Europe, we start to see that things are by no means as simple as that. So a lot more to discuss, but I just wanted to make that quick point. Thank you very much for the segment, Mark. Now, as we always do, a very big thank you to everybody that supports the column financially. We can only do what we do with your financial help, and it's due to a number of very generous people that take out a subscription and are providing us with the funding we need. So if you're watching UK Column and you're not yet a member, perhaps we can ask you very nicely to join and become part of our team to help us not only continue going, but to expand. And of course, you can always go into our shop and make a purchase, as that helps us financially as well. Now, we do what we do for information to be shared But please, if you do put our information out, will you make sure that it's attributed to UK Column? This is a nicety for us. It's something which also we think is reasonable. We go to the effort of producing it. But do we want other people to see and share our material? Yes, we do. So we'll leave that there. Now, I just wanted to say once again that we've got the Playing God video, Jackie DeVoy and her team, an investigation into medical democide in the UK. That's now being seen by a very large number of people worldwide, but you can still click on the UK Column website and have a look at that. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, I've got an interview, which is in my Gutsy Women series. It's with a lady called Rosie, and she's going to be talking about the White Rose organization, which is doing some really excellent work in educating people about what is happening in the UK and indeed worldwide. Why are our societies being attacked and broken down? And ultimately, what can we do about it? So this is one lady's story about how she went from watching to standing up and be counted. So please join me for that. Now, where does that bring us? It brings us on to the topic of mainstream media, legacy media. And a big thank you to one of our viewers who sent me over the weekend a link through to a Times article. Let's bring it up on screen. So here we are. It had it's a long article. It's got a lot of images in it. The headline is Exposed, the illegal school teaching children conspiracy theories at a grimy former nightclub. Pupils are told how to survive a plot against humanity. This is what our undercover reporter saw. So let's start off by having a look at the embedded video. I've broken it into two clips. Let's have a look at the first one.
This is not playgroup. If you're not learning, there's no point us doing this. And at the end of the day, we're bringing up a generation of children that do know the truth. They won't have to be woken up because they've never been asleep.
An undercover investigation by The Times has discovered a school in Manchester being run by a group of conspiracy theorists under the radar of the authorities. I applied for a teaching post at Universal Kids via an advert I saw in The Light, a newspaper that peddles conspiracies and misinformation. I was invited for an interview by LaDan Ratcliffe, a former teacher who set up the school in 2020.
Hello, I'm Tong.
Hi.
I'm here to meet LaDan.
Yeah. Okay.
Hi, LaDan. Hi.
Hi.
See you.
Lovely to meet you.
Yeah.
Ratcliffe told me that the purpose of the school was to de-indoctrinate pupils from all of the lies that they were taught by the system. After two interviews and a trial lesson, I was then offered a position.
So this is the playground, and it also grows around the side as well.
She helped parents to withdraw their children from mainstream education, register as home educated, then send them to Universal Kids. Parents pay £30 a day for tuition at her school. Teachers at the school adhere to the Great Reset theory, a conspiracy which claims that a shadowy cabal of bureaucrats and financiers are trying to depopulate and enslave the earth.
Well, it was pretty clear there because he's straight into the subject of the Great Reset. And as far as he's concerned, it's all conspiracy theory. One of my big criticisms of this piece of work by The Times is, of course, they never get into proper discussion with the people about why they're doing what they're doing and what they're seeing worldwide that means that we should be doing these sorts of things. So it's a hit piece, there's no question of that, but I just wanted to flag up for our audience that the Great Reset is apparently just a big conspiracy theory according to The Times and the journalist there, Tom Ball. Let's have a look at a second little clip from the video.
Head teacher Ratcliffe advertises the school primarily by word of mouth, but also through social media groups for like-minded conspiracists.
So many people are getting to know about our school, no. We're on a smaller scale. People are getting to know either through our teachers, our parents, when they advertise in various groups and things like that.
Amazing, you've got people coming from Shropshire.
Yeah.
There were 13 children, aged between 8 and 14 whilst I was working at the school in January. though there have been as many as 28 in the past. Despite this, Universal Kids has been able to operate for more than 3 years without any supervision or intervention from local authorities or Ofsted, the school's inspectorate.
Have you had much trouble with Ofsted here?
No. I've just told them we're not doing things that Ofsted would want.
Ofsted inspectors don't have the power to force their way onto the premises of suspected illegal schools or seize incriminating materials. The inspectorate believes that there are hundreds of illegal schools in England, exploiting the fact that there is very little oversight of home-educated children under current legislation. The vast majority of institutions prosecuted by Ofsted are religious schools, but in recent years inspectors have found a growing number of non-religious schools that have been set up by individuals radicalised by the COVID-19 pandemic into an anti-state and sometimes conspiratorial ideology.
Well, he gets there ultimately because this is all about regulation of anybody who's trying to provide an alternative education for their children. And notice how he's now talking about people who've been radicalised during COVID and have become anti-state. Diane, I'll just give you a few seconds to come in and comment if there's anything you'd like to say, having watched those clips. And of course, that's not the full video that the Times shown. It is two clips, so there were other points. But what do you think?
Well, Brian, I was just sitting here laughing, partially because I'm about to debunk what they've said here just a few minutes later in the news. I think it's just absolutely hilarious. This Times broadcast, whatever this was just absolutely off the mark when it comes to facts. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, of course, the news was one. The music in that report was one of the things that I couldn't help reacting to, because it's that mind-numbing music in the background to allow the propaganda, as far as I'm concerned, to sink in. Mark, I'm watching your face. Same to you. Just a couple of seconds, if you'd like to respond.
The best thing to say is that they always use this technique of stating something as if it's self-evidently false. Like, one day you'll be eating cockroaches if Klaus Schwab has his way. They don't ever look to see what Klaus Schwab had to say. They just state this, attribute it to the so-called conspiracy theorists, and make the reader believe that by definition, what these conspiracy theorists are saying is false, rather than exploring the issue to see whether it might have some truth to it. That's a common technique.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much for that. We're a good team because you were spot on the point that I'd lined up. Let's put the slide on screen. So here's Tom Ball. I know he does look a bit like Harry Potter, but I think he is the Times journalist. He said in a history lesson, I saw the children being told by their teacher, Justin, that they would one day be eating cockroaches if Klaus Schwab, head of the World Economic Forum, and Bill Gates have their way. So your point is absolutely correct, Mark, that no investigation into this by him at all. He simply states things as if it is fact. He goes on to say, in recent years, inspectors have found a growing number of non-religious schools set up by people radicalised during the COVID-19 pandemic into, and here's the key expression, anti-state and sometimes conspiratorial ideology. Now, I'm sure if Mike Robinson was with us, we'd be saying, you've got to watch out for this anti-state label, because more and more legislation is coming in place to close down anybody who challenges the state. But he flags up the real problem. They're worried about the increase. At the same time, the number of homeschooled children has increased rapidly from 60,000 in 2018 to 86,000 in 2023, according to the most recent figures published by the government. But he doesn't investigate why more and more parents are pulling their children out of school. He simply ignores that. And if we go on, he then reinforces his attack on homeschooling. Come back to the slide you just put on screen, please, Stephanie. That's the one. He reinforces it by quoting Sir Martin Oliver, the Ofsted chief inspector, who said in the article, the quote is of him in the article, the 2022 schools bill would have given us additional powers to investigate and close down illegal schools, but that legislation was dropped. Without those powers, I remain concerned that thousands of children across England are still attending illegal schools. So the state is getting very worried it can't control education of children. The point reinforced here by a quote in the article from Bridget Phillipson, who's the Shadow Education Secretary. It's frankly shocking that this school has been operating with impunity for so long and poisoning the minds of these young people. A Labour government would legislate without delay for a register of children not in school. So vote Labour, you're going to get more state control and more focus on your children and what's happening to your children. So if we bring Tom Ball back on screen, he was crowing in the article the last year. The Times exposed another what it said was suspected illegal school set up in Sussex by anti-vaccine activists and members. Here's the dig of the far right. What's he talking about? Well, he's talking about Hope Sussex. So this is very close to home for the UK column. But oh my goodness, they're teaching people how to use tiny crossbows. He doesn't seem to want to comment on the fact that we've got relatively young children being used to being trained to use real weapons before they're put into early days of the armed forces in a lot of schools. So no proper investigation by this man. Let's bring in the next quote here. He said, if schools like Eton and Winchester were established to educate the future administrators of state, Universal Kids was set up with a very opposite purpose. It's a training ground for a resistance movement where children are instructed in foraging, self-defense and natural remedies to survive and defy this supposed plot against humanity. But of course, he doesn't investigate the plot. If we have a look at him in more detail, this is his LinkedIn page here. He's a specialist in the Russian language. He spent, I think, time in Russia. But basically, this appears to be the best that the Times can do. And if you have a look at his Twitter account, he's bringing in stories which are hit pieces on Russia. And he's also bringing in stories which are hit pieces on Andrew Bridgen by callously using comments by Andrew Bridgen's wife in order to undermine the Andrew Bridgen himself. So I'm not impressed. But did Tom Ball do any investigation? Clearly no. Let's pop on screen evidence that's in front of our eyes. This one here says, in an effort to be more sustainable, elementary schools are serving insects during lunch. These issues are important. So this is not conspiracy theory. And the Times knows it. Let's pop the Times on screen. Here we are. Their headline is Eating Insects, My Creepy Crawly Breakfast Bowl. But apparently Tom Ball is completely unaware of this stuff. He's also unaware of the real fears that parents have got of their children being groomed within the very education system controlled by Ofsted. And for our audience, we'd encourage you to get back onto the UK Column website and have a look at our interviews with Kim Isherwood from Public Child Protection Wales, where she's been talking about how the minds of our children are being attacked, how they're doing that inside schools. Now, before I leave the Times, I just wanted to highlight that a little while ago, 2022, we were under attack by the Times. COVID conspiracy theories run wild on the channel for lockdown skeptics. This was a truly disgusting piece of journalism, which was just designed to smear. If we bring in a little bit more text, we can see the sort of things. Stirring music plays as images of Boris Johnson presidency and laboratory appear on screen. Two news presenters sit at a desk with papers in front of them while a ticker tape scrolls below. Now, we did challenge the Times at the time over this disgraceful article, and we'll share a little bit of the comment that we made. This was their headline, if we bring that in. UK column, conspiracy theories run wild on the channel for lockdown skeptics. An ex-Tory councillor is behind an online news service that spreads misleading information. Now, part of our response to the Times was this: Brian Gerrish is not and has never been a Conservative Tory councillor or member of the Conservative Party. Moreover, he's never been a Conservative Party candidate. William Coleshill, creator of Resistance GB, the ex-Tory councillor mentioned in the article, has no operational control or commercial relationship with the UK column. The UK column and its directors did not incite the alleged accosting of the BBC reporter Nick Watts on the 14th of June 2021, and the UK column and its directors were not present during the alleged accosting of Nick Watts. And finally, the UK column and its directors did not organise or attend the Clapham Common protest. We raised a lot more points, but really showing our audience today is to underline the fact that the Times is capable of some pretty appalling reporting. And in the case of the articles I've just, the article I'm just showing you, this was the journalist Ben Ellery. We'll leave it there. My advice: don't bother buying a Times, because you're not going to get facts and the truth about what's happening. But that's just my personal opinion. So, Diane, I think that brings us back to you, and you're going to come in on some of these points from your own experience.
Absolutely, Brian. Yes, I'm looking, well, not looking forward to the news that was in this, but what I want to go through is it's sort of an exercise in truly fighting misinformation and finding correct facts. And I'd like to introduce this firstly by reminding people about the webinar that happened on Friday evening that was sponsored by Andrew Bridgen MP around COVID vaccines, the devastating health crisis in the Channel Islands and around the world. And I have it was an hour and a half long. It's on Rumble and other channels if you want to look it up. I'm sure it's not on YouTube. But if you want to see the whole hour and a half webinar, it's available for you. But I'd like to highlight just three short clips from three of very prominent speakers who I've been following since 2020, 2021. The first one is Professor Angus Dalgleish, who is a professor of oncology at St. George's University of London.
Oncologists all over the world, from Australia, from South Africa, from America, from Canada, South America, Europe, they all said the same thing, and they all said that they were told it was just coincidence or a selection of anecdotes and to be quiet. Now, this is what the problem has been with this pandemic. It is being Orwellian control and denial of the facts and the total prevention of debate. Science is debate till you come to the right conclusion. So following the science or scientific consensus, these are complete misnomers. They are absolutely incredible that we've had to put up with this. I've had plenty of doctors come up to me and said, I would love to do what you're doing. I would love to join you, but I've got a mortgage and two kids at school I have to put through. That's what's been going on. They've been going for the doctors that speak up.
And that's definitely been my personal experience as well. So next we have Dr. Ryan Cole, who is an American pathologist. So first we've heard from the cancer expert, now we'll hear from pathology.
We need to change this. Synthetic DNA and modified RNA injections are not vaccines, never have been, never will be. They are genetic transfection agents and therapies. According to the filings of Moderna and Pfizer, they know this. We don't know the long-term consequences of these, and they're still being developed for hundreds of other conditions. It's not just these COVID shots. I know everybody has COVID fatigue. I understand that. What we need to do is stop this platform. It's not meant for human use. It's not ripe for human use. For a successful technology, reality must take precedence over public relations. For nature cannot be fooled. We are fooling ourselves and we're fooling nature. More injections, plain and simple, equals more infections due to immune suppression that Dr. Dalgleish covered. Cleveland Clinic showed this in a very straightforward study on their 50,000 employees. I'm not here to judge anyone that did or didn't get a shot. I'm just saying no more genetic shots, please.
And finally, I'd like to show a short clip from Dr. Peter McCullough, who is one of the most highly cited cardiologists in the world, based in Texas.
I'm convinced is the tip of the iceberg. The tip of the iceberg. The biggest published series of myocarditis before the pandemic, across decades and decades of accumulating data, was 500 cases. In my practice before the pandemic, I had only seen two cases of myocarditis, and one of them was fatal. Now there are papers, Lane et al. In the British Medical Journal Open, 18,000 cases in a single manuscript. I am seeing dozens and dozens of cases. In my practice, I have well more than several hundred cases with myocarditis. That is how common it is. And it's sad to say, I don't have a chance to see all of those who've died of a cardiac arrest. In the Holscher paper that I've quoted, the cause of sudden adult death syndrome is very likely to be vaccine-induced myocarditis. And it may be so sufficiently subtle, it couldn't be detected on an MRI, even if we got one.
Right. So with those quotes in mind, I'd like to think that the UK Column audience has been on top of this for, you know, the last 3 or 4 years. So these are things that maybe we saw coming, we already knew. But, you know, I'm really happy to see that the rest of the world is starting to wake up and starting to see what's going on. So going back to the Times and the Great Reset so-called theory, this was a published book called COVID-19, The Great Reset. I do not quite understand how Klaus Schwab and his colleague managed to have an entire book published in July 2020 about something that had apparently only happened in March 2020. So a quote from that book, which is published, the most recent biotechnology techniques using RNA and DNA platforms make it possible to develop vaccines faster than ever. They might also help with the development of new bioengineered treatments. So what did we see at the end of last week? We saw mRNA injections for cancer being rolled out. And so this is something from the World Economic Forum's website, a global risk report, which was done in collaboration with two insurance companies. So they're saying a variety of things here based on global risks, both for the next 2 years and the next 10 years. Now, first of all, the next 2 years, the highest global risk is misinformation and disinformation. And we see all these other horrible things that can happen to us the next 2 years. The next 10 years, as you can see, that the top major risks the next 10 years mean that weather and climate and biodiversity loss is going to make the world blow up and fall apart anyway. So I'm not quite sure why misinformation will matter when it's number five, when the rest of the world has blown up. But there we go. So when we look at what's going to happen from here, I want to take the viewers through an exercise in truly fighting misinformation and truly finding what is fact and what is not. So something that we've all been wondering about, if you've been watching Twitter in the last couple of weeks, is where is Klaus Schwab himself? Well, it was first published a couple of weeks ago on this website called The Weekly Crier, which is the first website that I can find that mentioned Klaus was hospitalized and maybe died. But we also see that they issued a retraction of that story, which you can see it on the right. You can also see another clue when you're looking for the validity and credibility of websites is that they usually have bad grammar and spelling. So you can see in their correction or their retraction, they spelled Klaus as Kalis, K-A-L-I-S. If you look at the Weekly Crier's About Us page, it says there very clearly that they also feature satire and comedic opinion pieces and editorials. So from this, we can see this is maybe something more like the Babylon Bee or the Onion or something that is not meant to be taken 100% seriously. So this spread to a couple of other websites, some other Twitter accounts, things like that. So, of course, all the fact checkers came in. So here's one from the Associated Press who said that it is not true that he was hospitalized and might have died. And they quote here, as they say, satire, comedic opinion pieces and editorials where they didn't directly mention the name of the website that started spreading this, but they did say that the WF spokesperson told the AP that the claims are untrue. But if we go down to the bottom of their claim here, and they said the word bug, so going back to your point in your segment, Brian, appears to be emphasized in reference to another false claim that the WEF wants to replace meat with bugs. And we see here on a Twitter feed, which was, so we had 2 million views talking about Klaus being seriously ill on other accounts. But if we go on from there and we look at a previous fact check on the next slide from the AP, this was from, I think it was the 2023, I believe, January meeting in Davos, where they said all the conspiracy theories are circulating because all the elites are arriving in Davos and everyone else is talking about this. And then they said, well, meanwhile, the popular claim that the forum wants people to replace meat with bugs is a distorted reference to an article once published on the organization's website, which is mentioned in the text of that so-called fact check. But if you go to the World Economic Forum website itself, and the point that I want to make is to go back to the original source as closely as possible to get the closest to whatever the truth actually is. And I just did a quick search for eating insects, and we get there almost 300 results in the WEF's search engine about eating insects and why it can reduce climate change and so on and so forth. So it's really, really important to go back to our sources. And so from here, when I was fact-checking, I just happened to see that the WEF is in the progress of, I think the special meeting ends today. So it was a special meeting in Saudi Arabia around energy. And so there are 3 themes that were going. I was looking to see if maybe Klaus was on the agenda, but I couldn't find his name. Unfortunately, I was hoping that would be one of the ways to verify whether or not he is still alive. But we do have 3 themes that are important to look at, apparently. One is a compact for inclusive growth. Not quite sure what that means. Revitalizing global corporation. And the one that catalyzing action on energy for development. I want to say that catalyzing, that misspelling was the WEF's, not mine. And here we can see once again that they are trying to affect the livelihood and lives of people. Quote, the number of people without access to energy, is not decreasing at the pace needed to achieve the sustainable development goals, particularly in developing economies. So we need poor people to have less access to energy to meet the sustainable development goals. So once again, language is inverted. Sustainable means unsustainable, at least when it comes to human life. The closing plenary, which I think might have just gone on just recently today, features, among other prominent speakers, the CEO of Moderna, David Cameron, and the president of the World Economic Forum. So all of those recordings from the meeting over the weekend and today are available online if you should so wish to subject yourself to them, Brian.
Diane, thank you very much for that. I'm wondering whether I should phone the Times up and say, do you want a proper investigative reporter to look at information? Because clearly Harry Potter, Tom Ball from the Times needs replacing. But the Times can't do this investigation. You're able to do it. And thank you very much for providing that through the UK column. Mark, we've got to an appropriate point to bring you back in, because, of course, if we're talking about these matters and health, we need to be looking at the World Health Organization.
Thank you, Brian. The WHO pre-pandemic treaty, of course, they want to negotiate that May 27th through June 1st at the 77th World Health Assembly. As that approaches, they're getting very strident, you might even say militant, about worldwide vaccinations with all inclusive language, vaccinate everyone everywhere. So I learned this past Wednesday, the 24th of April, covering in real time a WHO press conference. UK column is a registered media there. And we'll just go on from there. We'll get right into the meat of it in the interest of time. The big thing, the big takeaway, global partners announce a new effort, the big catch-up, to vaccinate millions of children and restore immunization progress lost during the pandemic. The clip you're looking at from the WHO is from 1 year ago, but when they had the press conference last week, that's when they really put it into motion. Now, this is from that press release of a year ago, and I'll just hit the highlights. The pandemic saw essential immunization levels decrease in over 100 countries. Oh, you know, perish the thought. The big catch-up is an extended effort to lift vaccination levels among children to at least pre-pandemic levels and endeavors to exceed those, led by a broad range of national and global health partners, much of it Big Pharma. The big catch-up also aims to ensure stronger primary health care services for essential immunization in the future. It involves Gavi, UNICEF, the WHO, the Gates Foundation, going on, pushing toward Agenda 2030, the strategic or sustainable development goals, rather, and so on. The effort aims, as it says in this next slide, to reverse the declines in childhood vaccination recorded in over 100 countries since the pandemic. And bumping down to the bottom of that, well, in the top part, it mentions vaccine hesitancy as another problem. People aren't even supposed to hesitate. They're just supposed to put that mRNA needle in their arm without even thinking. And then they mention with over 25 million children missing at least one vaccination in 2021 alone. Oh, the humanity, right? Outbreaks of preventable disease, including measles, diphtheria, polio, and yellow fever are already becoming more prevalent. Now, that can be a problem, true. But the narrative is that vaccines are the only answer. And we'll move on from there. This is Dr. Moaz Sana. He spoke, these are original photos I took, and he spoke at that press conference last week. And this is representative of what was said, as are other quotes that are coming up in a minute, Brian. He said this: we're launching the big catch-up with $290 million from the Gavi board in support of wanting to achieve the big catch-up by 2024-2025. Moving on from there. Gavi, of course, is the Vaccine Alliance. This explains a little bit more about what he was talking about. The successful start to Nigeria's HPV vaccine introduction in November and other introductions in Bangladesh, Cambodia, Indonesia, Togo, and other countries are crucial steps toward our target of reaching over 86 million girls by 2025 with HPV, with those vaccines. So-called vaccines. These efforts will be further boosted by the board's approval, that's the Gavi board, of an initial U.S. $290 million drawn from COVAX savings that can now be reinvested to fully fund doses for children to catch up on routine vaccinations that were missed during COVID-19. So that's a little bit more about that $290 million, and we'll go from there. And these are other quotes to round out what was said at that press conference. This is Violaine Michelle of the Gates Foundation itself. We are truly on course for a world of vaccination for all, she said, parenthetically, while recognizing field workers who work to vaccinate all children everywhere. She wanted that to be recognized, and we'll go from there. And here's Tedros himself, the director general. He's really on a messianic mission as the pandemic treaty World Health Assembly comes up, where they also want to talk about the IHR regs. He said more support is needed from donors. The WHO is dedicated to the life-saving nature of vaccinating everyone everywhere, quote, end quote. And this is Dr. Kate O'Brien, another apparatchik at the WHO. This is more of a paraphrasing. She spoke on misinformation, as Diane mentioned a minute ago, on the measles vaccine. She called it a safe vaccine, countering the misinformationists, and said the measles are highly infectious. Vaccines, she stressed, are the only way to go, while complaining that backsliding by the public has curbed widespread vaccinations. And we'll move on from there. Dr. Michael Ryan, who's the WHO Health Emergencies Program Director, also spoke at the press conference. Again, these are all photos I took. We must have a candidate vaccine ready at all times and be ready to act really, really quickly. A candidate vaccine, which makes it sound like it's something tentative that perhaps hasn't been tested much. Meanwhile, I received this while it was still embargoed. On the 26th of April, the WHO held its first high-level meningitis meeting hosted by the government of France. And as it says in the headline there, it's a joint news release. The WHO and France convened high-level meeting to defeat meningitis, and that's primarily a vaccine-preventable way of doing that, they're claiming. And then lastly, although I've got an announcement about the World Health Assembly, the joint FAO, WHO preliminary assessment of recent influenza H5N1 viruses. And what this says, without getting into the details too much, Brian, is that for now, the candidate for the next pandemic repeatedly is H5N1 or the bird flu. And what was stated was that it's not contagious at all. It has a very low contagious factor. But if a human catches it, it's now being claimed by the WHO that this would be more deadly than COVID-19, and they're keeping a close watch on it. Don't you worry.
Mark,
so, Brian, you might have at this point.
Mark, thank you very much for that. I know you've got an extra update. What I'd like to do is cover that update in UK column extra after the news. We've run over just a little bit, if you're happy to do that. But I'm going to say thank you for an excellent update. And we can see the power coming into play from the World Health Organization and, of course, our own governments simply denying that there is this global power base under the control of the World Health Organization. So lots more warnings to be given. We must end there. So Diane, Mark, thank you both very much for joining me today. It's been a really interesting news. Great to have you both here on UK Column News today. Biggest thanks goes to our wonderful audience, wherever you are in the world. Thank you very much for joining us. Please share the information, as I said. And if you're not a subscriber, consider joining us and being part of the team to make UK Column happen. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back in a few minutes for UK Column Extra. Bye-bye.